BBC World Service. Welcome to World Briefing with Michael Poles. The headlines at 9 hours GMT. Israeli aircraft, warships and tanks have hit Palestinian targets in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, including Yasser Arafat's headquarters. More than 100 people have been killed in a train fire in Egypt. And in a reference to North Korea, President Bush has said no country should be a prison for its own people. Also, around 2 million Muslims have begun the annual pilgrimage or Hajj from the holy city of Mecca. And a row is coming to a head between Germany and the Czech Republic over remarks by the Czech Prime Minister. This is the BBC in London. And we begin the programme with those stories in detail.
BBC News with Jackie Leonard. Palestinian officials say at least 11 Palestinians have been killed in overnight Israeli military strikes. The raids followed an ambush at an Israeli army checkpoint on Tuesday night in which 6 Israeli soldiers were killed. More than 30 people on both sides have been killed in attacks and reprisals since Monday. From Jerusalem, James Reynolds reports.
The strikes began overnight in Gaza and in the West Bank. Israeli forces destroyed Palestinian police posts in Nablus and in Ramallah, killing a number of police officers. Israeli warplanes struck Yasser Arafat's compound in Gaza City, killing members of his personal guard. And Palestinian officials say an Israeli missile hit a police post near the Palestinian leader's offices in Ramallah. The Israeli strikes have come after 6 soldiers were killed in an ambush at a checkpoint outside Ramallah, the latest in a series of increasingly sophisticated Palestinian militant attacks. Over the last few days, Israel has begun to suffer heavy losses, leading many to question the government's strategy in this conflict.
More than 100 people have been killed in Egypt when a passenger train caught fire near the town of Al-Ayat. Scores of other people were taken to hospital. The train was travelling from Cairo to Luxor. The cause of the fire is still unknown. From Cairo, Heba Salah reports.
Egyptian police sources say several dozen bodies have been found along the track. Eyewitnesses say passengers threw themselves off the burning train, which continued to travel even after the fire started. It finally came to a halt at the town of Al-Ayat, 70 kilometers south of Cairo. The train, which was heading to Luxor, was packed with people returning to their villages in southern Egypt ahead of the Bayram, the biggest Muslim festival of the year. Rescuers, aided by villagers, have been trying to free some of the people still trapped inside the carriages.
President Bush has described North Korea as a despotic regime during a visit to the demilitarized zone which divides the Korean Peninsula. Mr. Bush said no nation should be a prison for its own people. Earlier, he emphasized that he had no intention of attacking North Korea, despite his description last month of Pyongyang as part of an axis of evil. During talks with the South Korean President Kim Dae-jung, Mr. Bush affirmed American support for Mr. Kim's policy of engagement with the North. But in Seoul, violent clashes have broken out between hundreds of anti-US demonstrators and riot police. The BBC Seoul correspondent says many people are still unhappy about the strong language, which they feel could be a barrier to improved relations with the North. You're listening to the news from the BBC. Around 2 million Muslims are today beginning the rites of Hajj, the annual pilgrimage which will take them from the holy city of Mecca to the barren plain of Mena and the slopes of Mount Arafat in Saudi Arabia. The 5-day ritual is the largest yearly mass movement of people on the planet. This year's Hajj is the first since last September's attacks in New York and Washington and the ensuing war in Afghanistan. Mark Duff reports.
Among those who've made the journey are a few thousand Afghans, some 200,000 people from the world's biggest Muslim nation, Indonesia, and about 10,000 Americans. An increase on last year, despite earlier fears that many American Muslims would be deterred from going. The concentration of so many people in a relatively small area has in the past proved a recipe for disaster. Fire and stampedes have claimed the lives of hundreds of people over the years. But it's the potential for political unrest that is of the greatest concern to the Saudis this year. In the wake of September the 11th, the Saudi authorities have insisted that they won't tolerate any attempt to exploit the Hajj for political purposes.
The authorities in Sri Lanka have arrested a former government minister in connection with the massacre of 10 Muslim opposition supporters during December's general election. Anuruddha Ratwate, a former deputy defence minister and uncle of President Chandrika Kumaratunga, was flown to a court in Tel Danai, where he was remanded in custody. He denies all knowledge of the killings, which sparked mass riots between Sri Lanka's minority Muslim and majority Sinhalese communities. Police have already arrested 32 soldiers who provided security for Mr. Ratwate during the election campaign. The Indian Health Minister has confirmed there's been an outbreak of pneumonic plague in the northern hill state of Himachal Pradesh. Four people have died since the first case was reported in a remote village in early February. The area has since been sealed off. The minister, C.P. Thakur, said there was no cause for panic and the disease had been contained. 12 people are currently being treated in the main hospitals in Chandigarh and Simla. BBC News.
It's 9:06 GMT. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC in London. I'm Michael Poles. Israel's response to the killing of six of its soldiers last night by Palestinian gunmen in the West Bank was swift and targeted at the security apparatus of the Palestinian Authority. Israeli tank fire killed at least seven Palestinian policemen in the West Bank towns of Ramallah and Nablus. And Palestinian officials say Israel's bombardment of Gaza was the heaviest since the latest conflict between Israel and the Palestinians began nearly a year and a half ago. Four security officials were killed and two wounded in a rain of shells from Israeli warships. Our correspondent Caroline Hawley is in Gaza and has sent this report.
As day broke, Palestinian security officials surveyed the damage caused by the night's assault. Among the targets hit were several positions of Yasser Arafat's personal guard, Force 17. The deputy commander of the force told the BBC that posts within 20 metres of Yasser Arafat's house had been struck, as well as the Palestinian leader's helipad and a passport office. The Palestinian Authority's armoured cars, as well as a naval vessel, were also destroyed. Yasser Arafat's personal office was unscathed. Outside it, a sign in Arabic reads, "God, keep this country safe." The four security men who died were hit with a missile on the beach at the back of the compound at the beginning of the bombardment. Their colleagues were, this morning, resigned rather than angry. One said that as long as the Palestinians were continuing to attack soldiers and settlers, he was content.
Caroline Hawley. The Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is coming under increasing pressure with what critics say is the failure of his hardline strategy to curb attacks by Palestinian militants. In one recent opinion poll, almost half of those surveyed thought Israel's leaders had lost control of the situation. The Palestinians, for their part, have responded to the latest violence with a repeat of their call for a return to peace talks. Saeb Erekat is a senior Palestinian negotiator and cabinet minister.
The truth is, we need a meaningful peace process, and we invite the Israeli government to send its negotiators instead of its tanks in order to reach a conclusion to end this Israeli occupation. And I believe that the Israeli people must ask Sharon, where is the peace you promised us, and where is the security you promised us? Because I think the language of the tank, the F-16s, the Apache, will only add fuel to the fire.
Saeb Erekat. Mr. Sharon is now holding talks with his security cabinet, and sources say he may now order an intensification of strikes against suspected Palestinian militants. A spokesman for the Prime Minister, Dore Gold, says military action is the only viable response.
The question is, would an alternative approach work? Let's say, sitting with the Palestinians talking while they're shooting at us. We tried that policy. What about making very forthcoming concessions to Mr. Arafat? Well, we tried that at Camp David. Governments are elected to defend the population. And right now, the Palestinian Authority has been delivering a daily dose of death to the people of Israel through these coordinated attacks by a variety of Palestinian organizations. These must come to an end.
Dore Gold, who is a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister. A Montreal judge has blocked a Canadian intelligence agent from revealing most of his evidence against a terrorist suspect at a deportation hearing. The agent, Mourad Iklef, is alleged to have assisted Algerian-born Ahmed Rassam, who was convicted last year in the US for plotting a millennium bombing at Los Angeles Airport. The American authorities are seeking Mr. Iklef's deportation to and from Canada. But as Lee Carter reports, because of the judge's ruling, the defence is unable to hear most of the agent's testimony.
Claude Archambault is Mourad Deklef's defence lawyer. He is visibly frustrated by the secret nature of the hearing.
They don't have any direct evidence. Maybe they've got some, but I want to know, because to take the defence of my client, I have to know.
The agent from the Canadian Security Intelligence Service was actually called to testify at the hearing by Mr. Archambault. The defence lawyer wanted to challenge the agent to come up with direct proof that his client was involved in terrorist activities. But instead, the agent, only identified as Witness B, refused to give most details of the government's case against Mr. Deklef, saying that to do so would compromise national security. The agent was strongly backed by Federal Court Justice Pierre Blais, who cited Canada's new anti-terrorist laws. Furthermore, the judge says there is evidence that Mourad Deklef is involved in terrorist activities, but it's only been revealed to him by Canadian intelligence in closed-door sessions that the defence has not been allowed to attend. Mr. Deklef, originally from Algeria, has lived in Montreal since the early 1990s. Canadian government lawyers say that Ahmed Rassam identified Mr. Deklef as an accomplice in his Millennium bombing plot during FBI questioning. But so far, little evidence linking the two has been made public. The hearing is expected to last for two more days.
Lee Carter. A lawyer representing three Somalis who are Swedish citizens has travelled to New York to see if he can have their names removed from a United Nations list of individuals and groups who are alleged to have links with the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda network. The lawyer, Leif Silbersky, says his clients are all innocent men whose financial assets have been frozen because they've been included on the list. Greg Barrow reports from the United Nations.
The fate of the three Swedish Somalis who've been included on a United Nations sanctions list has gripped public attention in Sweden. The three men, who all claim to be law-abiding citizens, have been included on a list of groups and individuals with alleged links to the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda movement of Osama bin Laden. Their names were put forward by the United States, but so far the Swedish government says it can find nothing to incriminate them. Unfortunately, that doesn't protect the three men's rights. Under international law, UN member states are required to freeze the assets of any individuals whose names have been included on a UN sanctions list. Without the generous support of the Swedish public and civil rights groups, the three Swedish Somalis would by now be almost destitute. Campaigners say their plight has highlighted the extent to which civil liberties are being undermined in the fight against international terrorism. Leif Silbersky, a lawyer representing the three men, is in New York holding meetings with UN diplomats in an attempt to get his clients removed from the UN sanctions list. He says he's seen nothing to suggest the three men are remotely involved in terrorist activities or in contact with either the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. After a series of meetings at the UN, Mr. Silbersky is to make further representations to the State Department in Washington.
Greg Barrow at the United Nations. You're listening to the BBC in London. Today's main news, the Israelis have carried out an intensive bombardment of Palestinian positions following the killing of six of their soldiers. Around 2 million Muslims have begun the annual pilgrimage or Hajj from the holy city of Mecca. And President Bush has strongly endorsed the sunshine policy promoted by South Korea's President Kim Dae-jung, aimed at engaging communist North Korea. He was speaking at a joint news conference after talks in Seoul. But President Bush also renewed his condemnation of the North Korean leadership during a visit to the edge of the demilitarized zone, which divides the Korean peninsula. Caroline Gluck reports from Seoul on how his latest public statements have been received.
President Bush's public endorsement of the Sunshine Policy, aimed at bringing North Korea out of its isolation, will be greeted with huge relief by government officials here. So too will his repeated offer to the North to enter into dialogue. At their joint press conference, and later during his visit to the demilitarized zone, the two leaders were putting on a show of unity, stressing the common ground between them in their approach to issues from North Korea to the global fight against terror. Relief too at his statement that the US had no intention of attacking North Korea. But privately, the concerns still linger. While the two countries may essentially agree on the nature of the North Korean regime, key differences remain about the best way to deal with it. President Bush was unapologetic about his tough language in referring to the North as part of an axis of evil, saying that he would continue to speak out about a country which denied its people freedoms and tolerated starvation. While the president was making his remarks, noisy protests continued against his visit. The South Korean public have welcomed his more conciliatory tone and his fresh offer to talk to the North Korean regime. But many still remain unhappy about the strong language, which they feel could be a barrier to improved relations with the North.
That was Caroline Gluck in Seoul. A North Korean soldier is reported to have defected to the south through a point in the demilitarized zone close to the Dorasan railway station, where President Bush gave a speech just hours later. The Yonhap news agency in Seoul quoted the defector as saying he had no idea Mr. Bush was visiting the area when he crossed. The Governor-General of Australia, Dr. Peter Hollingworth, says he will not resign in response to allegations linking him with a child sex abuse scandal. It's been alleged that during the years when he was Anglican Archbishop of Brisbane, he failed to act against Anglican priests who committed sexual offences against children in church schools. Red Harrison reports from Sydney.
Speculation has been strong that with the Queen due to visit Australia next week, these allegations would compel Dr. Hollingworth to resign. They began to surface when a Supreme Court ordered his Anglican diocese to pay more than $400,000 in compensation to a woman sexually abused as a child in a church school. The teacher involved claimed, in his words, to have loved 20 girls. He committed suicide. Dr. Hollingworth said legal and insurance reasons prevented him expressing sympathy to the children or their parents. Dr. Hollingworth is also accused of having appointed a priest to investigate claims of sexual abuse, though that priest himself stood accused of offences against a choir boy. But the most severe criticism of Dr. Hollingworth followed his response to claims that he allowed a bishop to continue working after he confessed to having sex with a 14-year-old girl. The Governor-General made an unprecedented television appearance to suggest the girl might have enticed the priest. In a 10-page statement explaining his refusal to resign, the Governor-General says he never sought to cover up any offence and never prevented anyone going to the police.
Red Harrison in Sydney. Queen Elizabeth has gained first-hand experience of the economic and social problems facing Jamaica. She toured a crime-ridden neighbourhood in one of the poorest areas of the capital, Kingston. Correspondents say the visit went ahead as phone-in programmes on local radio stations questioned the relevance of the monarchy to an independent state where crime, a drug culture and unemployment arrive. Jamaica's problems were further underlined when a state banquet was plunged into darkness by power cuts. The meal was completed by candlelight. A senior United Nations official, Ross Mountain, has urged the international community to put aside any difference it has with the government of Liberia to come to the assistance of some 60,000 people caught up in the country's military unrest. Liberian government officials are enduring targeted UN sanctions because of what the Security Council says is their involvement in gun running and diamond smuggling. Our West Africa correspondent Mark Doyle reports from Abidjan.
There is undoubtedly a humanitarian crisis in Liberia. A week ago, on the road towards the capital, Monrovia, I met Cecilia, a young mother caring for two pretty toddlers while heavily pregnant with a third. She had fled from one refugee camp to another, escaping the men with guns. The day after I met Cecilia, her third child was stillborn, no doubt from the trauma of its mother being a refugee. The senior UN official, Ross Mountain, gives a wider picture for 60,000 war-displaced Liberians.
These are people who have not just been displaced once, but they've been displaced multiple times, and they've been reduced to, on the one hand, having to carry their worldly goods on their head, and on the other hand, looking for their family, who many of whom have lost track of wives, children, and so on.
The Liberian government stands accused by the United Nations of fomenting unrest in neighbouring states, and previous UN appeals for money to help the war displaced have consequently fallen on deaf ears. Some aid workers in Liberia say government soldiers are at least as bad as the rebels when it comes to mistreating civilians.
Our West Africa correspondent Mark Doyle. It's just coming up to 9.20 GMT. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC World Service. A reminder of today's top story. Israeli aircraft, warships and tanks have hit Palestinian targets in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, including Yasser Arafat's headquarters. Now the rest of the news. The German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer arrives in the Czech capital Prague today for a visit that looks set to be overshadowed by a diplomatic row over comments made by the Czech Prime Minister Miloš Zeman. Mr. Zeman recently caused outrage in Germany by calling ethnic Germans expelled from Czechoslovakia after the Second World War Hitler's Fifth Column. Then, this week, he was quoted as comparing the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to Hitler and saying the Israelis should follow Czechoslovak post-war policy and expel the Palestinians. Ray Furlong reports from Prague.
The German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer is arriving in Prague amid a storm of controversy surrounding the Czech Prime Minister Miloš Zeman. During a visit to Israel this week, Mr. Zeman was quoted as comparing Yasser Arafat to Adolf Hitler, drawing criticism from the European Union, which supports dialogue in the Middle East. But even before that, he caused widespread offence in Germany by describing ethnic Germans expelled from Czechoslovakia after the Second World War as Hitler's Fifth Column. Around 2.5 million ethnic Germans were expelled after the war, often amid much suffering for alleged collaboration with Hitler's forces, but they say they were treated unjustly and deserve compensation. According to some reports, the German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder is so angry about Mr. Zeman's comments that he's considering calling off a visit to Prague planned for next month. The German opposition leader Edmund Stoiber has also strongly criticised Mr. Zeman's remarks. Mr. Stoiber's home state of Bavaria is where many of the expelled ethnic Germans settled, including his wife.
Ray Furlong reporting. The Russian Defence Minister Sergei Ivanov is to visit Washington next month. The announcement comes the day after Russian and American delegations meeting in Moscow admitted that there were still what they described as difficult issues between them. They said they might not be able to sign an agreement on nuclear arms reduction when President Bush visits Russia in May. From Moscow, here's our Russian affairs analyst Stephen Diel.
Mr. Ivanov might have expected to visit Washington as part of the preparation for Mr. Bush's first trip to Russia. But the failure of this week's talks to clear problems which lie in the way of a new nuclear arms deal has given Mr. Ivanov's visit an added urgency. After the breakup of the talks on Tuesday evening, the two sides were trying to play down their differences, even suggesting that it wouldn't be too serious if the agreement were not ready for signing when the two presidents meet in May. But both Moscow and Washington know that the failure to sign a deal would be a setback for their new relationship, forged after the attacks on the US on the 11th of September. Indeed, a number of questions are already being asked about the strength of the Russia-US alliance. The two countries may be united in the war against terrorism, but they seem as far apart as ever in other strategic matters. Washington announced its intention unilaterally to pull out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, despite Moscow's protests. And whilst the Americans agree that it makes sense to reduce their nuclear warheads, they insist that they'll put many of their undeployed warheads into storage rather than destroy them, a prospect which has angered Moscow. But the inability to reach an agreement this week suggests that, as with the ABM treaty, Washington may end up simply doing what it wants. Such a move will cause the hawks in Mr. Putin's military to ask if there is any real gain for Moscow in this relationship.
Stephen Diel. The president of Turkmenistan, Saparmurat Niyazov, has marked his 62nd birthday with an announcement that every citizen reaching that age should receive special privileges in honour of the Muslim prophet Muhammad, who was that age when he died. President Niyazov called for a 3-day holiday for those reaching 62 and announced that they would also be given a small government stipend. Despite official celebrations marking the president's birthday in the Turkmen capital Ashgabat, several former officials now in exile are voicing strong opposition to Mr. Niyazov's regime. Here's our Central Asia correspondent Catherine Davis.
62 is a milestone in everyone's life, said the Turkmen leader, and celebrations marking that milestone for him began on Monday. State television showed a traditional lamb sacrifice in the village where Mr. Niyazov was born. Thousands of people attended, including the Turkmen leadership and foreign diplomats. A lavish concert and firework display was broadcast nationwide too. Known as Turkmenbashi the Great, or Father of All Turkmen, President Niyazov has ruled this desert state uncontested since Soviet times. He's become the center of a personality cult unrivaled in the region. Towns, schools, monuments, and roads all bear his name. Children sing their loyalty each day. Last year, Mr. Niyazov published a spiritual code for the country, intended to guide Turkmen people and restore their cultural heritage. The President for Life has justified his policies by portraying himself as a strongman, able to maintain social and economic order.
Catherine Davies. Ford, the global car giant, will today bring to an end nearly three-quarters of a century of vehicle assembly at a vast factory in East London here in Britain. Around 1,000 workers will lose their jobs, although that's been done without compulsory redundancies. At its peak, the Dagenham plant employed 40,000 people. It was originally intended to supply Ford's production for the whole of Europe. Mark Gregory reports.
I'm standing outside Gate 34, the main entrance to Ford's Dagenham car assembly plant here in East London. It's a huge rabbit warren of a place, a maze of nondescript industrial buildings. It's hard to imagine that somewhere so unprepossessing was so important to the development of the British car industry. I've just been talking to some workers as they came to the end of one of their last shifts, gauging their reaction to the fact that production is going to cease after 70 years.
I got no job and I'm not very happy about it. I've been here a lot, 23 years, and I've worked here a long time.
I can understand why the company is closing down. It's just a survival. It's streamlining and it's going to affect all of us. And personally, myself, I am very sad about it.
The mood was so different when the Dagenham plant first opened all those years ago.
That September 1931 saw the first vehicle being driven off the conveyor by Mr. A.R. Smith, the general manager.
The plant was conceived on a truly epic scale. It was Ford's first venture into Europe. It was Europe's first real taste of the modern mass manufacturing techniques the company had pioneered in America. David Burgess Wise has written a book about the factory.
This was modelled on the River Rouge plant in Detroit, which Henry Ford had built to build the Model T. And the idea was that Dagenham would have bodybuilding facilities, foundry, chassis-making facilities, engine-building facilities, all on the one site.
Dagenham remained at the heart of Ford's business in Europe for more than half a century, but the plant's image was seriously tarnished in the era of strikes and picket lines that gripped British manufacturing in the 1960s and 70s.
But it's up to them to stay from the union. He'll be banned if he's a black pig, if he's a scan.
The plant never quite recovered from the militancy of the 1960s and 70s. But author David Burgess Wise says its future recently seemed assured when Ford promised that Dagenham would be the main production site for the next generation of its top-selling small car sold in Europe.
It's only a few years ago that they made a major investment there and said that Dagenham was going to be the European centre for the production of the Fiesta. So I think it's probably more an internal political move rather than an inevitable move.
The end of car assembly at Dagenham marks another big milestone in Britain's long retreat from large-scale manufacturing. But it probably isn't a disaster for the nation's overall economy. These days, Britain's prosperity depends largely on service industries. And right now, it's one of only a few big advanced economies that's not in or on the edge of recession.
That report by Mark Gregory. A reminder now of today's main world news. The cycle of violence in the Middle East has continued, with the Israelis targeting the Gaza City headquarters of Yasser Arafat and other Palestinian installations. I'm Michael Poles, and you're listening to the BBC in London.